Hello neighbours, welcome to Fit to Eat, the Newfoundland Labrador Farm and Food Show. I'm Ivan Emke, your host. This is episode 28 of season 2. Maybe you've heard the statistics about the median age of farmers in our country these days. As a whole, it's somewhere between 55 and 56, and in our province, it's about a year or so older. Of course, this is influenced by our definition of who is a farmer, but don't get me off track here. To show you how serious this aging thing is, the other day, I started to wonder if maybe the average age of farmers was actually beginning to be as old as the average age of, priests. So I looked it up. Phew, we're okay for a while yet. The average age of Catholic priests in Canada is in the low 60s. We have some time. But what about other occupations? Well, the average age of real estate agents is about 52. For lawyers, it's just over 47. These are occupations that seem to be replenishing their ranks. But there are a few young people getting into farming, a few who are bucking this trend, a few who are bringing these stats down a bit. So today, I talked to a young farmer. I don't ask him his age. I just know that he is well under the average, and that's good enough for me.
Sometimes I say it's one of my biggest problems with farming is I like too many aspects of it, whether if it's growing crop or growing different types of livestock. You know, overall, I definitely don't regret any of the choices that I've made along the way for farming. Yeah, I'd definitely do it over again. You can have a great-tasting fresh white egg, no difference than a brown egg. An egg is an egg. Actually, every egg starts off white on the inside. If we're looking at trying to provide Newfoundland with its food, we have to look at being able to do it where the farmer can make money as well as get it to those wholesalers at a price that's compatible where they can get it from elsewhere.
I like to follow the careers of young farmers to see how they're doing over time. Early in the first season of this show, I talked to Nathan Dennis. He had just set up a layer hen operation in the Cormac region. He worked hard to get to that point, lots of investment, plenty of work, responsibility, but he welcomed it. So earlier this year, I caught up with Nathan again, this time on Zoom, pandemic restrictions being what they were. Zoom is an imperfect medium, but it was quick and accessible. You know, fast communication, kind of like fast food. Join us.
Since the last time I talked to you, so how have things been on the egg front?
They've been okay. I mean, industry-wise, it's fine, but for our farm in particular, it's been a little bit of a struggle. Just as a new entrant and, you know, starting any kind of new business venture, and some steep learning curves and some mistakes along the way.
But how many chickens do you have right now laying here?
Currently, we got just under 3,000 on hand, but a little later this month, we'll be filling the other barn up with, placing up another 3,000. So we'll be roughly on the 6,000 mark.
And where do the eggs go? Do you sell them mostly? They head to St. John's or?
Yep, they pretty well all go to Newfoundland Eggs Inc., the grading station on Roach's Line. And then from there, the large and extra large, they go to Costco and or any grade smaller than large. So medium and downwards would be shipped out of province. I never remember which province they go to, but they go to the processing plant.
So we're exporting eggs.
Yeah, well, we do. We actually export a lot of eggs.
Do we really? Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. I remember, were they brown eggs that you had?
Yes. Yeah, we did run a bit of white for one flock, but we pretty well all do them brown. This kind of seems to go with what the consumer kind of thinks of when they're thinking of a free-run egg. It's a brown egg. It's, you know, that backyard type of idea. But now there has been some mention from the grading station that there may be a potential market for a certain number of whites, so we may look at placing white birds again. For me, I don't care what color bird it is or what color egg. Comes in. I don't care if it's purple, as long as I can make money on it.
Well, you'd certainly make money on a purple egg, I tell you. That's So it makes no difference in terms of feeding, you know, or anything like that in terms of it's just the breed of the hen, basically.
Yeah, basically, yeah. It's just breed. And when we did run some white birds, you know, we had 2,500 browns and we had 1,200 whites, all in the same barn, same feed tank, same water lines, everything were the same, just the egg come out a different color.
I see.
When we were packing, it was a bit of a nuisance trying to pack the eggs separately. So some days, if we weren't too busy, we'd collect them separately. We'd have a basket for white and take a basket for brown. So that was a little quicker for kind of depend how busy we were.
You're right. The people do have this perception that if it's brown, it's better for you. Sort of like brown bread, you know, like whole wheat, whatever, you know. Is there any nutritional difference in the egg?
If there is any, it's not even enough worthwhile talking about. Like, it's not, I really don't think there is any, but if there is, it's not a percent or two. It's a fraction of a percent or something. The only difference people make with the brown and the white, a lot of times they just, like I said, they have that perception of brown eggs or that idea of growing up at your grandmother's or your uncles or maybe even your parents, depending. But I've heard people saying lots of different things. You know, well, growing up, my grandmother always had a few hens and they were nice brown eggs. You went and collected fresh every day. And so there potentially could be a taste difference, but not from a nutritional value or because of a feed difference or whatever, just freshness differences maybe. But I mean, you can have a great tasting fresh white egg, no difference than a brown egg. An egg is an egg. So actually every egg starts off white on the inside. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the color's just added after. So some hens have printing pads and other ones don't.
If you really want to get an authentic egg, you know, when I was growing up, it'll always have a little bit of manure on it as well.
Yeah, CFIA kind of frowns upon that these days.
I guess they would.
Okay, let's take just a moment here to breathe and take in this information from Nathan. You see, a comment around the nutritional equality of brown and white eggs often ends up in a flurry of angry letters. So there is readily available research on the nutrition of eggs and the lack of connection to shell color. Different breeds of chickens lay different colors of eggs within limits. Sometimes it relates to the colors of their feathers, but not always. The color on eggs is deposited on the shell in the hen's shell gland pouch. Well, that's what we'll call it here. Or you can refer to it as the paint station. It's the last part of the egg creation process. Just like painting a shed is the last part of the process of creating a space to hang out. All eggs start out white, and eggs that end up white simply skip their stop at the paint station. Now, in terms of cost, some point out the brown eggs are actually more expensive to produce because hens that lay brown eggs can tend to be larger than white egg-producing hens and require more feed and more care. So you can't judge the nutrition of an egg by its color. By the way, despite the science, I often buy brown eggs when I can. I just like the way they look. Now that we've questioned the myths around egg colors, let's get back to the conversation.
Your hens are they free run?
Free run, yeah. They roam in the barn. They're free in the barn. Now, they don't have access to the outside, but they have access to wherever they want to go inside their pen in the barn. So.
Is there a price premium on that? Do you get a little bit more?
Yeah, we do get a slight premium on it, but that's just a direct factor that it costs more to produce.
I was wondering if it covers the additional cost or not.
Yeah, well, it helps offset it, at least anyways. You know, our current setup that we do have is manual collection, so there's lots of labor intensive and there's more egg wastage just because the birds have access to them and stuff. We're actually currently going through, I guess, looking at changing things with the farm, still staying with free run, or that's the plan as of right now, but just finished going through getting a new business plan done and looking at putting in some new automated equipment. So like I said, the birds would still be free run, or that's the current plan, but to be, you know, the barn would be as automated could get for a free run system. You know, we always get a certain percentage of floor eggs, so we'd still have to walk through every day to see the hens that didn't go to the automated nesting system. So, but we won't have to go and collect all the eggs manually and bring them in and repack them.
So you have other aspects to your farm as well. So you've got some other livestock.
Yeah, we keep a few beef cows and we keep a few sheep and raise a few hogs in the summertime, just a few market hogs. We don't have no breeding stock. We just buy them in as wiener pigs or piglets, whatever you want to call them. And we raise them out to market size and get them processed in the fall.
Do you get them processed there locally in Cormac area or?
No, we don't actually. And nothing wrong with, I mean, we are farming, majority of the farm is now in Cormac, but we still farm a bit in Port-au-Port. But I've been dealing with my butcher I've been using before this slaughterhouse started, the newest one here in Cormac. I was dealing with the other slaughterhouse, and other than distance to go to where he's to, as of right now, I don't have any reason to leave. Like, he's providing me with a decent service and decent quality work and that kind of thing. So I don't really have any grounds to leave other than the distance of travel to go to him. I appreciate loyal customers, so I try to practice what I preach if I can. Yeah. So
one of the big problems some people have all across Canada in different places is access to abattoirs and that there's a long waiting list. But you've got somebody you've dealt with for a long time. You probably don't have that same problem.
Usually pretty good, long as we give him a bit of a heads up. Like, we try to plan things. He's a slaughterhouse, an abattoir, but he's also, they do a lot of meat cutting in the fall for the outfitters and for the, you know, the big game and stuff, moose hunting season. Long as we kind of plan ahead, then he tries to squeeze everybody in, and if somebody's stuck, he'll still try to squeeze them in. The farm animal still brings in a percentage of his income, so you can't really turn it away. So, and I think it's probably proven to kind of help him out during the pandemic, because there's not a lot of out of province, or at least for the fall, for outfitters and that kind of thing. So, you know, he had a number of customers from the farming community that he kept, because he made sure that he served them well before as well.
Do you have a piece of music that I should use here? Were you expecting me to ask about that?
I never thought of it. When you mentioned it then, I remember from the last time, nothing right off the top of my head anyways. I think the last song we used, last interview, was an Alan Jackson song, I think, Small Town Southern Man or something.
clear creeks and cool mountain mornings, honest work out in the field, cornbread in my mama's kitchen, daddy saying grace before the meal. Family ties run deep in this land, and I'm never very far from what I am. I was born country, and that's what I'll always be, like the rivers and the woodlands, wild. I got 100 years of down home running through my blood. I was born country, and this country's what I love. Moonlight, and you here beside me, crickets serenading. What more could two people ask for, laying here in love beneath the stars? Now this is where I want to raise my kids, just the way my mom and daddy did. I was born country, and that's what I'll always be, like the rivers and the woodlands, wild and free. I got 100 years of down home running through my blood. I was born country, and this country's what I love.
That was Alabama with their song Born Country, as suggested by our guest today. I kind of bugged him until he broke down and suggested this song. I get the sense that he's a country music fan for some reason. Today, I'm talking over Zoom with Nathan Dennis of Cormac, a farmer who knows perfectly well that chickens come before eggs, at least in terms of his farm. I start out this section by asking about the variety of products that he raises and grows on the farm.
Yeah. You have some vegetables too?
Yeah, we do some. The last couple of years, we haven't done much just because we've been a little too busy with the layer barn, and but we did get a few acres of crop in last year, and mostly just pretty much potatoes is all we got in.
Are you thinking of trying to continue to do this? You have quite a few chickens, and then you have a few animals, and so you want to have a kind of a diversity in terms of your mix?
I think diversity works well for me personally, and not just from a business perspective, but just for me personally as a farmer. Sometimes I say it's one of my biggest problems with farming is I like too many aspects of it, whether if it's growing crop or growing different types of livestock. But I just think it's doing a couple number of different things, but on a smaller scale. You know, like I'll just use an example, like for beef cows. Well, if I can get up to 20 cows or maybe even 40 cows, that would be probably the biggest I'd want to go, versus just being, say, laying hens and like 100 cow beef herd. I'd rather do, say, 40 beef cows and say 40 sheep and just keep things changed up a little.
What kind of cattle do you have? What breed of beef cattle?
Heinz 57, basically. They're a little mixture of everything. Some of our cows that we have, and some of our heifers that we even have coming in now, they would have some dairy background to them, but they have beef mixed into them, and then we breed those back to a purebred beef bull. The end product you have is, the majority of it is beef, but you have the cows have that dairy background, which produces more milk, you know, say the most typical beef, and then we keep in those heifers, and eventually we're kind of breeding the dairy out of them too, especially for what I'm at. Sometimes it's easier to just get a couple of beef cross heifer, you know, heifer calves from a dairy farm that's around and raise them out and keep them for cows. Like I said, breed them back to beef and then keep their heifers, and eventually you're basically breeding the dairy out of them.
There's been this move to bring in a bunch of shorthorn genetics. That would be people doing strictly beef.
And I think it's a good program. I think one of the things we just have to look at is how big our beef market is. You know, it's one thing to sit down and say that we bring in X number of pounds. Yeah, that's what Newfoundland consumes. But can we produce that beef to the stores at a compatible price of what they can get it for from, say, Atlantic Beef Products in Prince Edward Island, or from mainland Canada or the U.S. or even Mexico? I mean, there's times I see certain grocery stores advertising Mexican beef. You know, it's like everything, whether if it's the vegetables or if it's beef or any kind of meat product, there is that percentage that you can sell at a direct direct market or through local markets or whatever the case is. But in the grand scheme of things, we still have to look at the wholesale market. At the end of the day, there's still going to be your Dominions, your Colemans, your Sobeys, and the other stores that's involved with those. If we're looking at trying to provide Newfoundland with its food, we have to look at being able to do it where the farmer can make money as well as get it to those wholesalers at a price that's compatible where you can get it from elsewhere. You know, it's great to have that product, but I guess biggest thing is making sure we got a market for it as right. We're growing. If we grow it too quick, and then all of a sudden everybody's got it and everybody's trying to move it, and a lot of times that can drive the prices down.
Yeah, you're mentioning that you need to be able to sell to the stores, and stores have a particular thing that they're looking for, which would be supply year-round. With something like eggs, you've got a marketing system set up. So for something like vegetables or root crop, that's always more of a challenge, I guess, unless you have your own cold storage.
I think we could have produce available year-round, you know, with the technologies out there today and the type of equipment we have and being able to insulate storages and control the climate so much, I think we could have a quality product. But at the same time, you know, you got to be able to do that economically and have a product that, you know, the wholesalers want. But not only just the wholesalers, I mean, the wholesalers are looking for what the consumer wants. You know, I spoke with a wholesaler not all that long ago, and I said to him, I said, well, you know, if I had carrots available for you year round and I could supply your store 100%, would you buy 100% for me? I said, or would I be competing 50-50 with mainland farmers? He said, well, if the consumer is looking for 100% Newfoundland product, he said, we'd be looking for 100% Newfoundland product. But he said, if we still have consumers coming in and they want, you know, a Soller's Gardens carrots from Nova Scotia, he said, no good for us to put something on the shelves that we can't sell. Part of it is the wholesaler, but a part of it too is the everyday consumer. I mean, if the everyday consumer is demanding it, then there's going to be a market for it. If they're not demanding it, well, then there's no market for it.
So the consumers have a fair bit of power still.
Yeah. Like he uses an example, you know, they can have 10 pounds of potatoes on sale from local farmers here on the West Coast. But then, you know, if the regular price is on to the russet potatoes from PEI, some people want that russet potato from PEI and they're going to pay a regular price for a 10 pound bag versus buying the one that's on sale from locally. Some consumers just have it in their mind that PEI russet potato is the best potato you're going to eat, and you're just not going to change their minds.
I don't know where they got that idea.
Well, I don't know either.
You've worked with the Federation. You've been active with them and Horticulture Society. And you still have any time to do that kind of?
No, actually, I stepped down from the Horticulture Producers Council. I didn't make it to any of the meetings last year just because I was busy. I did some traveling in Ontario January of 2020 just for doing some barn tours and looking at some new equipment for the layer barn. And then when the Hort Council meetings were on the go, it was roughly the same time that I went over and viewed a few farms in Nova Scotia, and I went to the Canadian Young Farmers Conference in Prince Edward Island. And then shortly after I got back, then, well, all hell broke loose. So,
yeah, let's talk about that all hell broke loose. So there's this little thing called the pandemic. How did it affect your operation?
Actually, for us, away from the eggs, we actually got a lot busier. You know, like for a local product, whatever we had, we moved. So did really well on that side of things. For the egg side of the business, you know, we didn't see any difference. It was a little bit leery for a little bit just because, you know, we are producing a specialty product. So then you kind of stop and wonder and think, well, when people are going to buy the essentials, are they going to be looking for free run product, or are they going to be looking for the first dozen or flat of eggs or whatever? But everything seemed to have moved, and we didn't have any issues in that regard.
Like, people were baking more, and were they using more eggs? Did the consumption go up?
In overall, table consumption went up. Like, I didn't see it directly to our farm, but as an industry perspective, table consumption really went up. And from my understanding, there's basically a carton shortage across the country, because majority of our product, you know, there's a certain percentage of eggs that's produced that go to the table market, so they go in cartons. Then a lot of them, like, that's going to bakeries and restaurants and institutions, right, that kind of thing. They go into your flats of 30. So, you know, you don't take a whole lot of packaging for that. But then all of a sudden, when all the restaurants closed, people were staying home to cook their own breakfast or to bake or whatever they were doing, then table egg consumption went through the roof. So that put a higher demand on the cartons. The carton manufacturers weren't really prepared to be trying to put out that much extra cartons. But then you also had the flip side of it too, that sometimes you're short on employees because, you know, of course, with the pandemic, if you didn't feel safe going to work, people didn't go to work if you didn't feel safe. So then you're short staff. So then therefore your production lines weren't as full production as they should have been because you didn't have people to run them. From my understanding, that's how it worked out. Like, some of the Sobeys were carrying flats of 30 mediums. That's one of the approach they had taken was, well, okay, to keep up with the table market, we got a bunch of medium eggs here. There's lots of filler flats. That's what, you know, the 30 flats are called, a filler flat. It says there's lots of them because they're always manufacturing those for the more or less the industrial side of the egg products. You know, I said, how about we start packaging them in trays of 30? And that's actually how my eggs are marketed to Costco. My run eggs are in trays of 30. Table demand definitely went up.
I was born country, and that's what I'll always be. Like the rivers and the woodlands, wild and free. I got 100 years of down home running through my blood. I was born country, and this country's what I love.
By request of my guest, that was Born Country by Alabama, the band, not the state. Today we're visiting Cormac, virtually, and talking with Nathan Dennis, who raises layer hens, beef cattle, sheep, a few pigs, and some vegetables. Let's head back to that conversation. I start out by asking if he had any problems getting access to feed or other inputs during COVID lockdowns.
No, for the most part, everything stayed pretty streamlined. Another part of what I do here in the spring, you know, I typically go to Nova Scotia and bring in so many piglets, many for us to raise. But I also supply a lot of local people, like raising two or three in the backyard. But this year, it just exploded. Typically, like I bring in probably 60 to 75 piglets a year. Out of that number, I would typically keep 8 to 10 for myself to raise. Actually, last year, once the pandemic hit, I actually ended up bringing in 150. And only kept 10 to raise.
So were some of these new people or people who had never raised?
We just picked up more customers, and we had a few people who had brought in pigs before, and they had a bit of trouble with their supplier from before. So then they were individuals that, you know, kind of took the small orders, and then they give me a lump order, you know, whatever it was, 12 or 20 or whatever the case was. So
are these Heinz 57 pigs, or are they like a Yorkshire?
No, they're a three-way commercial cross. So the mothers would be Yorkshire Landrace cross, so that's what the sows would be, and then they're bred to a purebred Duroc boar. Now our pigs averaged 161 pounds for dress weight on a pig, so that was just over 80 pound sides, but that's typically a good average size to have when we're selling it to customers.
One of the things that happened too is, well, people discovered pigs, but they discovered chickens too, and a lot of people were getting chickens in their backyard. Do you get asked about that? Do people try to buy chickens off you sometimes?
Oh, we always get people looking and saying, you know, we wouldn't have a couple of chickens we sell. Nope. I suppose it doesn't really affect us a big lot. I mean, of course, every egg that's produced in the backyard is an egg that you're not going to sell. But chances are the majority of the backyard guys, they're not getting the same production that we're going to get as from a commercial producer anyways, because, you know, it's not under ideal conditions. Yeah, I say some people too, like they think, yeah, it's a piece of cake, you get a few birds, you raise them up, and they don't factor in the cost of raising them, getting them to 18 or 19 weeks. And most likely if you're raised in the backyard, it's going to take 20 to 22 weeks before they start laying eggs. So it's a cost of doing that too.
When you get yours in, what age are they? How long do you have to wait until they're ready to lay?
The majority of them start laying by the time they're 19 weeks old, but you'll see every bird or every animal or human is going to mature at different times than the next one. So we try to have our birds in the barn by 17 and a half to 18 weeks old. What I found personally, if you bring them in and they're already laying, then that interrupts their lay cycles, or lay cycles already started. So then the way I kind of try to explain it is basically, if you interrupt your lay cycle, it's like you trying to get a run for a hill, but then all of a sudden you got to stop at the base of the hill, then you got to try to make up speed to climb again. When you bring them in and they're not laying, then they get used to the barn, they get settled in before they start the lay cycles, and then they have a nice good run for the hill, and they can make it up that hill, and they can peek out real nice, and you get good production. But if they're laying when you get them, then they go through the stress of moving them from their grow barn into our production barn.
You mentioned you'd been at a young farmers event, and you've been one of the poster child young farmers in Newfoundland and Labrador. Do you think it's easier to get into farming now than when you first started doing it, or is it about the same?
I think there has been some changes, but I think it's probably the same level of challenges as before. Some things easier, some things a little harder. So it's still about the same.
Would you still do it again if you were back at that age when you first started farming? Would you choose that again?
Yeah, definitely would. I don't regret, you know, there's, you know, of course there's things you could do along the way that you'd say you'd change, you'd do differently if you had the chance. But, you know, overall, I definitely don't regret any of the choices that I've made along the way for farming. Yeah, I'd definitely do it over again.
What time do you start working in the morning? When do you have to first get to your chickens?
Well, right now we're just running one flock and they're placing the barn at a later time. Is one thing in the layers we can kind of control when we have to work them because we control the lights and that kind of stuff. But we typically, we have the older flock at a later time of the day and the new flock earlier in the day, and we offset them so that when we're in collecting eggs, by the time we get the first batch of eggs ready, then the second batch is ready. So you don't have them all ready to one time. So it gives you a chance to get them picked up before the birds do too much damage. So current flock is now our older flock. So we have them set later in the day. Now, once we place birds at the end of the month, our days will have to start earlier because the lights for those will be coming on a bit earlier in the morning. But typically now, probably around 8 o'clock, we don't have to go too early for them.
Do they lay every day, most of them?
Yeah, the majority of them. Like right now, our flock is a bit older. The current flock is about 8 months in production now, and they're still around 90 to 92% production. 90 to 92% of the birds in the barn are laying an egg every day. But an egg cycles every 25 hours. So that's why you never get 100% production, because every so often you will skip that day.
Thanks for chatting. It's nice to catch up a bit. I'm glad that things, you know, in the midst of the pandemic, you had some positive things happen as well.
No, overall, I must say the pandemic didn't really, and that's like the social distancing. I mean, really, we don't socialize that much as farmers anyways. We're too busy to really go anywhere and socialize. For us, you know, there's some changes, but for the most part, I can't really say it affected us that much. Like I said, that, you know, it was a little bit concerning at first, and it still potentially could be. I mean, if, you know, depending if things didn't continue to improve with the pandemic, you know, if it took a turn for the worst, you know, are people going to be looking for that specialty product? Probably not. They're probably just going to be looking for the store and get what they need, and that's it, you know. And it depends, I guess, where our economy goes. If people got the extra money to spend, they'll spend it on a specialty product, and if you don't, well, they're going to look for the cheapest product that's there.
Is there a big price difference between your eggs and other eggs, or?
I don't really know, to be honest with you. I haven't been to Costco in St. John's since I actually started selling eggs there, which was almost 3 years ago. But I think the last I heard, there a flat of 30 was retailing for $9.99. So that's the equivalent of $4 a dozen. You know, to go into most grocery stores, you're not going to get a dozen regular large brown eggs for $4 a dozen.
Good. Well, I'll let you go and finish your day there. And thanks for chatting with me over this interesting little technology.
Yeah. Hopefully this is over soon enough and you can come back and visit in person.
Yes, I hope so too. Yep. Well, do take care.
Yes.
Take
care, Nathan. Okay. Bye-bye.
I was born country, and that's what I'll always be. Like the rivers and the woodlands, wild and free. I got 100 years of down home running through my blood. I was born country, and this country's what I love.
And as the internet connectivity spirits start to act up, we say farewell. By the way, Nathan was still in his barn when we chatted. It was likely well after 10 p.m. He was generous with his time, since he still had a few things to clue up before closing up for the night. Such are the joys of being a farmer.
For me, I don't care what color bird it is or what color egg comes in. I don't care if it's purple, long as I can make money on it. I think we could have produce available year-round with the technologies out there today and the type of equipment we have and being able to insulate storages and control the climate so much. I think we could have a quality product. If the everyday consumer is demanding it, then there's going to be a market for it. If they're not demanding it, well, then there's no market for it. I think diversity works well for me personally, and not just from a business perspective, but as a farmer.
This has been Fit to Eat, the Newfoundland Labrador Farm and Food Show. To listen to other episodes of this show or for more information, go to fittoeatnl.ca. The music for today's show was Born Country by the band Alabama. The theme music, Cluckold Hen, was performed this week by Berklee College of Music's American Roots Ensemble. This is a production of Kitchen Table Communications. I'm Ivan Emke. Join me again next time. I'll be right here. Happy trails.
And that's like the social distancing. I mean, really, we don't socialize that much as farmers anyways. We're too busy to really go anywhere as a socialize.